Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day. Are you approaching retirement, or maybe you've just changed jobs? If so, you'll probably now have control of your 401k or IRA. Would you like to buy some property, notes, loans, start a new business, or even buy crypto? You can with a self-directed IRA. For more than a decade, I've been telling you about setting up a self-directed IRA through IRA Advantage. And while you may now hear other companies say they offer self-directed IRAs, you need to find out if they're truly self-directed. With a truly self-directed retirement account, you can make any investment the law allows. Whether you're talking about true diversification, starting your new business, or investing in private holdings, IRA Advantage through a truly self-directed IRA can make that happen. Take it from me, Lars. You've worked hard for your money. IRA Advantage will work hard to keep it yours.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com. View our videos and call IRA Advantage. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
I just have one simple question for Oregonians. Are you happy with the way that things are going? That's what this election is about.
That is Christine Drazen, who's seeking the governor's office in Oregon, and this is the Lars Larson Show. Welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 and a half years. And we have what I call the best conversation in talk journalism right here every day. And you're welcome to join in, even if you're a naysayer. In fact, especially if you're a naysayer, you'll go right to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can always send an email instead, and we take naysayer emails that way, too. Talk@LarsLarson.com. Doesn't get much easier than that. I'll get to our Twitter poll in a moment, but I'm just glad to have you with me. By the way, I know that Hurricane Ian has just made landfall in Florida at this hour. It just happened just a few short minutes ago. We're going to be keeping an eye on developments there, where that Category 4 storm at last report is hitting with 155-mile-an-hour winds. And I would urge you to say a prayer and spare a thought for our fellow Americans in Florida. But I want to talk about the governor's race, because this is so very, very important. And as you know, I always disclose my dog in the fight. I don't vote in Oregon. I used to. I vote in Washington State. But people ask me what my recommendations are, and I'm happy to give them for what they're worth. I think that and $2 at Dutch Bros will get you a cup of coffee. But for the first time in about 80 years, Oregon has three major candidates running for the governor's office instead of two. And voters have a choice of a left-wing, abortion- and tax-loving Democrat, a former Democrat, and a nominee of the Republican Party, Christine Drazen, who you just heard a moment ago. And you've heard two of the three on this show. Both Betsy Johnson and Christine Drazen have been willing to come on and answer questions from me and give you a chance to hear what they say when they're asked those questions. Only Tina Kotek, who has been invited time and time and time again, has declined to want to answer those questions. And I suggest that shows something wrong with her. The fact that she's not willing to take tough questions, heck, I'll take tough questions from anyone. Last Friday, as I was flying back from Washington, D.C., I ran into Democrat Senator Jeff Merkley. We call him Senator Berkley because he's a liberal, too. And I said, come on my show. He said, I'll only do it if you give me the exact same amount of time you get. I said, done deal, Senator. Now let's go. He said, I'll only do it if you'll answer questions from me, too. I said, done deal, Senator. I'm glad to answer any questions you want. I'll set aside as much time as you want, and I'll give you the same amount of seconds on a stopwatch that I get. But let's get back to the governor's race. I hope that voters choose Drazen and not Betsy Johnson, and not Tina Kotek. And let me explain why, because Johnson can't win. And let me prove that to you. The polls are showing that Oregon voters may finally end the state's disastrous slide to the bottom by electing the first Republican governor in 35 years. Now, people ask me about polls, and I say, look, I don't think polls are definitive. You know, they're nothing that you can look at like a gas gauge and say, I know exactly what that measurement is. But they do tend to tell you where the wind is blowing. The poll commissioned by the Daily Dead Fish rapper Oregon Live shows Christine Drazen leading, but within the margin of error by a single percentage point. But she's leading Tina Kotek. And here's the way the Fish Wrapper actually reported on their own poll that they commissioned from an independent pollster, DHM, which has a pretty good track record, by the way. 32% of likely Oregon voters said they would vote for Drazen if the election were held today. 31% said they would vote for Kotek. Betsy Johnson, the longtime Democrat lawmaker who is running unaffiliated, got 18% support. That puts Drazen, the former House Republican leader, and Kotek, the former House Speaker, in a statistical tie for first place given the poll's margin of error, plus or minus about 4%. 15% of voters remain undecided. So that's the same result as a poll that was done in August. So millions of dollars in negative ads and months of campaigning have not changed many minds. Good. Voters are thinking for themselves. It also shows that Johnson, get this, this is the math you're up against. Betsy Johnson would have to win 50% more votes than the polls indicate she has right now just to catch up with Kotek and Drazen. And we have just over 2 months, just over 1 month until the votes are actually counted on November the 8th. If you like the way the state has gone, with a lackluster economy, with top companies leaving the state for greener pastures, sanctuary status for criminal illegal aliens, legalizing hard drugs, and tolerating rampant homelessness and riots and neighborhood shootings, then vote for the status quo. Here are my concerns. Betsy Johnson cannot win this race, and yet too many Republicans have decided not to support the Republican nominee for governor. Yesterday, on this program, the former head of the party, Herman Bartschiger, who I also consider a friend, told me on this program that one of two reasons he backs Betsy Johnson is because she went. The polls say she can't. She would have to make up a 50% increase in the people backing her. And if she got 50% more based on the poll, she'd still be at 27%, and Kotek and Drazen would be in the low 30s. So if 3 months of campaigning has not moved the needle for Betsy Johnson, I want to ask you, what makes it likely that the former Democrat, Johnson, will increase the number of voters who support her by 50% in the weeks that remain before the ballots go out in late October, or just over a month till the votes are actually counted? Right now, Johnson's run makes it likely that Oregon will elect its first Republican governor as long as Republicans do not abandon their own candidate, Christine Drazen, chosen by, I'll remind you, registered Republican voters in favor of a former Democrat who has no statistical chance of winning. If they do, then Kotek wins, and we get more of the same disastrous policies that have nearly wrecked the state. Now, if you're one of those undecideds, or you've already said, well, I think I'll vote for Betsy Johnson, think about those numbers. If she doesn't have a statistical chance of winning, you are throwing your vote away and you're helping Oregon get 4 more years of crazy Democrat policies that have wrecked the state, that have ignored crime in your neighborhoods, that ignored Antifa and BLM riots in the streets and murders and everything else that came with them, including a record rate of homicide last year in the city of Portland, and likely to be another record breaker this year. Now, those Republicans who've told me that, they say, well, I want to pick somebody who can win. I don't pick based on who can win. I don't even pick based on friendship. Betsy Johnson would tell you that. When the great Ronald Reagan first became president during the transition in 1980, his director of personnel said, personnel is policy. This applies to personnel who are on the ballot. Well, last June, the Supreme Court finally gave back to the states the right the Constitution has spelled out for 200 years. States decide issues like abortion. That was not true during the 50 years of the mistake of Roe v. Wade. It is true today. One of the three candidates, Christine Drazen, is pro-life. The other two favor abortion. Betsy Johnson is a former board member of Planned Parenthood. A vote for Drazen is a vote for the right to life, and a vote for Drazen, frankly, is a vote for a candidate who can actually win the office. And if you decide not to cast that vote, or you decide to vote it for an independent candidate who doesn't have a statistical chance of winning, then you are throwing your vote away. You ask for my opinion, and you got it. Coming up in a moment, I want to talk about one particular ballot measure that's coming up, Measure 114. It has to do with your Second Amendment rights, and it proposes an outright ban on buying all guns by all citizens. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
I hope you realize that one of the votes you cast in November proposes a total ban on the purchase of guns by law-abiding citizens in Oregon. Now, you've heard plenty about background checks for guns. Truth is, in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, anyone who buys a gun must go through a federal background check. In Oregon and Washington, there's a local background check required as well already. That's already in the law. Measure 114, which is on the ballot in Oregon this November, takes the requirements to a de facto ban on buying guns. Let me explain why. It requires that you get a permit before you buy a gun. The permit is issued by law enforcement. But to qualify for the permit, you must take a class. And Measure 114 requires that class must be done by a law enforcement agency. But Measure 114 does not require law enforcement agencies to offer the class. You see, it's kind of catch-22. Estimates say the cost of doing all of that, you know, the permits, the classes, and everything else for law enforcement is between $30 and $40 million a year. Measure 114 does not direct law enforcement to even offer the class, nor does it provide the money to make it happen. That makes it almost certain that some law enforcement agencies, if not most of them, especially in the more liberal big blue cities in the state, law enforcement will simply say, we don't have to do it under the law. You didn't give us any money to do it under the law, so guess what? We're not going to do it. So if you can't take the class, then you can't get the permit. And if you can't get the permit, then you can't buy the gun, even if you already own guns and even if you have a clean record. Democrat candidate for governor Tina Kotek is promoting passage of Measure 114 because she knows what it will do. It will effectively ban the purchase of all guns by all private citizens. The Republican candidate, Christine Drazen, and the independent candidate, Betsy Johnson, both oppose the measure. The choice is yours, and your Second Amendment rights are what's at risk. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
The way has been paved by Trademark Paving. Just pave it. Serving Southwest Washington.
Well, today I'm going to give the Daily Grill to a major Northwest utility company, PGE, for giving away money taken from all of our utility bills to buy electric school buses that simply don't make sense. They call it grant funding, and what they do is they cover the cost, the difference between the cost of a brand new electric school bus and a regular diesel-powered or propane-powered school bus. The difference is about $250,000. Now, I can't get the schools to give me the actual numbers, but I've gone to one of the major transit agencies in the Northwest in the past, TriMet, and I asked them, how much difference is there in operating costs? Because you still have to charge the electric bus or you have to put diesel in the diesel bus. And the difference is about $2,000 a year. Now, if you're paying an extra $250,000, that means the payoff time is somewhere north of 100 years, except school buses don't last for 100 years, which means the investment, as they like to call it, does not ever pay off. And if that makes sense to anybody, I'd be glad to take the naysayer call. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Mobile Joe's RV Collision. Get back on the open road and back to your adventure with Mobile Joe's. No body damage, too big or small. Collision or paint repairs, Mobile Joe's RV Collision fixes them all. John writes in, listening on the Radio Northwest Network, Lars, both California and Washington have committed to all-electric vehicles, displacing gas and diesel starting in 2035. However, with fewer than 15% EVs in California, there are already problems with electric grid blackouts with just the demand for AC. So why are we not hearing about the additional electrical resources that will be added to support all the new EVs? Also, coal, oil, and nuclear power generation have already been removed in the Northwest. In addition, dams and natural gas resources are now on the chopping block. Does anybody think about the consequences of these actions? And why are we not hearing any discussion of this in the news? Well, you hear it on my show, John, but most of the rest of the news, they want to ignore the problem until it's right in their face. To your calls now. Let's start out with Eric in Redmond. Hey, Eric, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. You know, I'm so glad you're out there, and I'm glad you have so much reach. I don't know what we'd do without you.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if Johnson ends up as on the ballot as the Republican nominee,
Hold on. Eric, you must be missing something. Oregon held its primary election in May. Christine Drazen was chosen as the Republican nominee. Tina Kotek was chosen as the Democrat nominee. Betsy Johnson doesn't have to run for the nomination. There is no nomination. She's running independently. The general election is in November. That's the final choice.
Okay, I'm sorry. I guess, you know, I just figured I'd catch up with the news in October, but I heard you today. And it sounded Johnson was on the ballot.
Johnson is on the ballot as an independent candidate. She spent about $1 million to gather enough signatures to get herself on the ballot as an independent. So in the general election, it doesn't matter which party you're with, if you're with any party. You don't even have to be registered in a party to be able to vote in the general, but I'm glad we could bring you up today. Let's go to Will. Hey, Will, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Lars. Great program. You ought to be doing something in the Senate and the Congress, but I know you won't.
No, I won't. You're right.
The absolute Ross Perot thing is the same thing as Betsy Johnson. We all know it. You better vote Drazen or you're not going to change nothing.
I couldn't agree with you more. And, Will, thanks very much. Let's go to Dave in Central Washington. Hey, Dave, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind? Hey, Dave. I think Dave kind of gave up on us. Dave, are you there? I wanted to talk to him about Measure 114, but apparently he's decided to take a powder. Well, Dave, sorry to miss the opportunity. But no, folks, the primary was held in Oregon in May. The primary in Washington was in August. The nominees have been chosen. And please understand this. The man who called in about Ross Perot is right. If Ross Perot had not run for president as an independent candidate and pulled about the same percentage that Betsy Johnson is pulling, about 18%, we would have had 4 more years of George Herbert Walker Bush as president instead of Bill Clinton and everything that came with Bill Clinton, sad to say. But the fact is, Johnson's having that same effect, but in a different way. Johnson is a former Democrat. So I figure she's pulling votes more away from Tina Kotek than she is pulling away from Christine Drazen, which means Oregon has a ripe opportunity to have a Republican elected as governor this November. And I hope that that happens. And I can't say enough about Measure 114. I mean, look, I own guns. I like to be able to buy guns. But the idea that you're going to tell people you have to take a class, but law enforcement doesn't have to offer the class, that's going to offer a golden opportunity for some of the police agencies, which don't exactly get excited about private citizens owning guns, to say, well, if we don't have to offer the class, we're not going to offer the class. And if you don't get to buy a gun, well, you're going to have to go to court and fight for your Second Amendment rights. And that's just dead wrong. Vote no on Measure 114. It's a Wednesday, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. We talk a lot about energy on this show, and I was intrigued by a story that I saw at WWeek.com, and I thought we'd talk about it with Nigel Jaquas. He's not the author of the story. We should give credit to him. But Nigel is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter from Willamette Week. Nigel, welcome back.
Hi, Lars.
So if I understand this story by Anthony Effinger, it says that we could, in the Northwest, see a private investment of billions of dollars to build a plant that all by itself would produce more oil every single day than Oregon and Washington use every single day. Do I have that about right?
Well, more. Just to be clear, more renewable diesel. This would, in fact, basically double the output of renewable diesel in the whole country. There's a line in the story which is accurate. We would become the Kuwait of the renewable diesel market.
And by renewable diesel, they mean diesel made from fish guts and other kinds of biological wastes, right?
Correct. Could be made from animal carcasses, could be made from used cooking oil, although that's in scarce supply. But the feedstock that this plant has attached itself to that would be new for Oregon would be taking all the leftover fish gills and fins and bones and carcasses and converting them to paste and running it through the refinery.
Okay. Now, the only thing that held me up a little bit is I looked at the numbers. They're saying this thing would produce 50,000 barrels. That's a little over 2 million gallons of biodiesel a day, every single
yes.
day. Do we have that much fish guts?
Well, no. Anthony researched that, and he thought that there might be 10 to 20, 10 to 20 million gallons of it available, and you lose some when you refine it. So we're nowhere close to that. Nowhere
10 to 20 million gallons.
Yes.
Per day?
Yeah.
State generates 10 to 20 million gallons a day.
Ten to twenty million gallons a year have been available of fish waste as feedstock. What do they do with it right now is if they can't use it for refineries, they basically throw it away. I mean, it's what's left when they've taken every usable bit out of the fish because, you know, there's a lot of stuff in fish that's used in all kinds of ways beyond food. It's used for cosmetics. It's used for fertilizer. It's used for pharmaceuticals. When they've taken all the useful bits out of it, then there's still this kind of greasy paste left that they can run through a refinery.
Okay, so that's where the numbers got me screwed up because say it was 20 million gallons a year that's available of that, you know, available waste, you're going to divert it away from fertilizer and other uses, which I assume means those costs are going to go up. But it works out to about 50,000 gallons a day, and then you divide that by 42 to get barrels. It's maybe 1,000 barrels of oil a day, which is not inconsiderable. But 1,000 barrels of oil a day in a country that uses 20 million barrels of oil a day doesn't sound like much of an addition, does it?
No. I mean, look, if they could actually build a refinery that produced 50,000 barrels a day of renewable diesel, that would be a hell of an addition for the state. We've got a diesel problem in this state right now. We've got old trucks that burn dirty diesel and it makes a big mess in the air. So if you could fix that, great. Everybody's better off. But
I agree.
I think what Anthony's reporting would suggest is there's not that much fish waste available. And we're talking about a $2.5 billion investment here. That's what the cost of building this plant would be. That's a lot of money, and it's not clear that these guys who are trying to do this, and by the way, the plant would be out in Columbia County at Port Westward, where there is an existing oil terminal and a couple of power plants. It's not clear this is going to happen. So,
okay.
You know, we're,
and really, Anthony's story is more about the fact that even in clean, green Oregon that usually loves all the environmental stuff, you know, whether it works or not, they don't like the idea of the plant being there, and it might have a tough time finding a home anywhere in the Northwest.
Yeah, you know, I think one way or another, Port Westward ends up as sort of the location of last resort. So these guys who are proposing this plant, one of them has previously done some stuff around Spokane and just across the Columbia in Washington. Neither of those were also clean energy plants. Neither of them went well. They both ended up in a mess, and both environmentally and financially. And so whether they have the wherewithal to come up with $2.5 billion, whether there's enough fish grease or other feedstock, unclear. There's clearly a market for this stuff because of the credits that they would generate for producing renewable diesel, but it's not clear that there's enough money to pay for the plant or enough feedstock to run through it.
You know, Nigel,
they're gonna get the permits.
I always call myself a numbers guy, but you're a numbers guy times 10 compared to me. But this is the part that bothers me. They're out selling their idea, which, fine, if they can do it, good. And they say, we'll do it all with private money. We're not taking any tax incentives, which is a little bit of a fib, I thought I saw in the story, because they're saying, we're not taking any tax incentives to create the plant or run the plant, but when they sell the fuel, the biodiesel, they're going to make bank on the tax incentives that are built into, you know, paying a big premium for biodiesel, aren't they?
That's true. The idea of the biodiesel is that every barrel that they produce, they're going to get credits that they can sell to the people who are still producing, you know, conventional diesel or other fossil-based fuels. So it's technically true that they're not asking for a subsidy, like they're not asking for state grants or state loans or property tax breaks, but they will be producing, if they were to operate, a lot of tax credits, which are in a way another form of subsidy. Yes.
Is there any way of doing a dollars to dollars on that? Like if you buy a gallon of regular diesel today and the price hasn't come down as much as gas has come down, and gas has now gone back up, but if you're buying diesel today, how much of a subsidy do they have to offer in dollars per gallon to be able to get somebody to produce biodiesel? Do you have any idea?
I really don't. I want to say it's around 50 cents, but I wouldn't hold me to that number. So, no,
okay.
It's considerable. It's considerable.
Well, and that's the concern I'd have. But when I first saw those numbers, I thought, you know, 50,000 barrels a day, 2.1 million gallons a day. I mean, that would be considerable if you figure the United States is about 20 million barrels a day is what we use to run our economy. And yep. Oregon is about 1% of the U.S. population. So 1% means they'd produce enough biodiesel, in theory, to produce all the fuel that's burned in the state every single day if they had enough fish guts.
Yeah, yeah.
But the fish guts may be a problem.
And they would. It's worth noting they would achieve the carbon reduction that we're supposed to achieve by 2030 as soon as they turn this plant on, because yeah. It would, if all the fuel were burnt in Oregon.
And then again, the other fun part to this, did you see that Joe Biden has decreed that there will be wind turbines off the Oregon and California coast?
Yeah, I actually was reading a legislative report about that yesterday. It's pretty interesting.
The technology's not there. No, the part the fishermen find interesting is they say these platforms all have to be anchored to the bottom, which means the cables are about 3 miles long. And the fishermen are saying to me, hey, you're going to lock up a whole bunch of the West Coast as off limits to fishing. So wouldn't it be the height of I guess, humor, a dark humor, but dark green humor, if they said we're going to build the fish guts plant, but then we're going to build windmills that will make it impossible to generate the fish guts to feed the fish guts plant.
Yeah, you got a lot of unintended consequences when you start making new policies.
You can read the story by Anthony Effinger. It's at WWeek.com. Nigel Jaquis is a good friend of the show. We'll be back in a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And why won't prosecutors lock up dangerous people? I'll give you a good example next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. A couple of weeks ago, there was a story about a woman who was found in another woman's house. The woman had apparently just wandered into the house. Lay down on the bed that belongs to the 10-year-old son of the woman who lives there. And when the woman came into the house from her backyard, she finds this woman asleep in the bed, scares the daylights out of her. Well, now she's apparently back in Multnomah County Jail. She was arrested last night on charges of theft, disorderly conduct, furnishing false info to the cops. Police say that 54-year-old Terry Zinzer was harassing people at one location. Witnesses at a bar said she was harassing customers and trying to break into vehicles. Then she stole some things, allegedly, from the 7-Eleven next door. She was supposed to be arraigned yesterday afternoon, but guess what? District Attorney Mike Schmidt-Show actually said, he said, no complaint. What that means is the DA's office looks at charges and says, we're going to do a no complaint on that. That's their term of art for simply saying, nope, we're not going to prosecute. But she's still in custody because she's on for a county hold out of Clackamas County related to an attempted robbery charge. Does it strike you as a little bit strange that we've got too many people in the Northwest who commit too many crimes? I know they're not at the level of rape or murder, but these are the kinds of crimes that make people scared for their own lives and their own safety. And the local DAs, like Mike Schmidt Show, simply say, we're not going to prosecute them. To our first naysayer of the day, Douglas in Blatchley. Hey, Douglas, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. Thanks for calling. What do you and I disagree about today?
You know, I keep when you guys talk about the energy, nuclear power goes right along with everything else in the line of conversation.
Well, it should, but it doesn't, because there aren't any nuclear plants under construction in America, and not likely to be either.
Oh, well, I really like to hear that kind of talk, but
what
I've been hearing is that they're coming out with these personalized nuclear plants that
are not necessarily personalized. They're smaller scale, so they're easier to finance, easier to build, and in fact, within a week ago, we were talking about NuScale, which is a company that found its roots at Oregon State University. Dr. Yeah. Jose Reyes has been on this show a number of times, not lately, but we'd love to have him back. But one of the best nuclear plant design companies in the world is located right here in the Northwest. And one of the reasons it doesn't come up more often in Oregon, I hope you're aware, there's a law on the books in Oregon that says it's illegal to build any nuclear plant in the state of Oregon. And I would imagine in Washington State, if you were to propose one, even one that was privately funded, the environmentalists would have a cow. They seem to hate nuclear power for reasons that even the environmentalists can't explain. And so they won't build them. And one of the reasons they don't come up more often is that nobody's pushing the idea of building them. All of us on the right who say that global warming is not caused by humans primarily, we can produce the energy we need. Nuclear is a big part of the solution. But the environmentalists will fight it tooth and nail. If you proposed one today, Douglas, if you had all the money, if you were as rich as Bill Gates or Jeff Bezos, and you said, I'm going to build a nuclear plant, I'm going to fund 100% of it out of my own pocket, I would just about guarantee you that you would be 20 years in the courts and environmental reviews before you turned over the first shovel full of dirt.
No doubt. And, the thing is, right
now, you see why it's not part of the conversation more often, Douglas?
Yes, they would.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. If you can't build them, then it's like, okay, well, what if we had a beanstalk? Well, you can't build a beanstalk. Let's go to Steve in Federal Way. Hey, Steve, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hey, I was listening to you when you kind of gave the framework of Measure 114 for Oregon.
Yep.
And I started to think, I said, isn't that like having to have an ID to vote? To go see the police. And I mean, this is for everybody. What about
It is like having an ID, except Steve, if you wanted an ID to vote, if you had never driven a car in your life and you wanted to get an ID, how long do you suppose it would take you at the DMV office? A couple of hours at most?
Maybe.
Yeah,
but I think with what they want to do, it sounds like it's absolutely against the whole left's thinking of social justice.
You missed the sneaky part of it. Yeah, it's like playing a game of Simon Says, and except in this case, maybe that's a bad comparison. It's like playing a game where you say, well, how do I buy a gun? Well, you get a permit. Well, how do I get a permit? Well, you go to law enforcement. Okay, what are they going to want from me? My name, DOB, Social Security number, all that? No, they want you to take a class first. You say, well, where do you take the class? You say, from law enforcement. Well, who offers it? Nobody offers it. It's a catch-22 written into the law that if the voters approve Measure 114 in November, it will say you must have a permit to buy a gun. You must take a class to get the permit. Law enforcement, you must get the class from law enforcement, but law enforcement is not required to offer the class, nor are we going to pay the money it's going to cost to provide the classes. So what do you think law enforcement's going to do when you tell them, we'd like you to offer a class, but you don't have to, and we're not going to give you the money to get it done? What's law enforcement going to do?
Well, they don't even have the cops to put on the streets.
Well, exactly. They're going to say, we're already busy with all this other stuff. If you're telling me we should offer a class that we're not required by law to offer, and you're not going to give us the money to pay for the cost of doing it, law enforcement is just going to say, well, conveniently, we don't offer the class. And so when you, the citizen, say, I want to buy a gun, they say, all you have to do is get the permit. And to get the permit, you have to take the class, and law enforcement isn't required to offer the class, so you can't buy a gun. It's effectively a ban. It's about as sneaky as the Democrat liberals get, and that's why you ought to vote no on Measure 114. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits, at least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for 22 and a half years. It's great to be with you, and I'll be glad to get to your calls. We've got a lot of people waiting at 866-HEY-LARS. Although, I'm loving the naysayers. If you're a naysayer, meaning you disagree with my point of view, we more than welcome you. We put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. You can also send emails to talk at LarsLarson.com, and you can vote in our Twitter poll. We put up a brand new poll question every day. Is it time to repeal Measure 110, Oregon's de facto legalization of hard drugs? Now, for Washington instead, say, is it time for the legislature to actually make up for the court decision that got rid of the hard drugs law in Washington state? But in Oregon, it was a choice by the voters. And yet the experts are now saying, listen, nobody's going to go to treatment unless there's a legal way to give them a little nudge in the direction of treatment. And right now, if you get caught with hard drugs, you get a $100 fine that is forgivable if you call a 1-800 number and talk to somebody about treatment. Not if you take treatment, if you just talk to them about it. So I'd say, yes, it is time to repeal Measure 110, Oregon's de facto legalization of hard drugs. Our Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, we've got an election coming up, and because of that, we make the generous offer, I think. We feature candidates from Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And one of them who's running is Kim Rice, the Republican candidate for Oregon's State Senate District 18, which happens to be the west side of Portland, which is more than a little bit on the liberal side. Kim, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on, Lars.
How are you going to win as a Republican in a generally liberal area like the west side of Portland?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm doing. I'm going to every single door. I'm knocking on every party affiliation, and I'm connecting with the voters, and I'm finding out what their issues are.
That sounds like a good start. Now, I'd like to know from you, if you got into the state legislature, we don't know who the governor is going to be. It could end up being a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent. I think it's going to be the Republican, Christine Drazen. But assuming you still have a largely Democrat legislature, what would you like to get done, and how are you going to do it? What are your top issues?
Yeah, so basically, I want to tackle the education issue. I think lots of Oregonians agree that we need to have choice in education and also money following the student, and that's going to improve because right now we're in the bottom in the country. And Oregon's like 47th, 48th in the nation as far as educational excellence. And, you know, in the 8 years that I've lived back in Oregon, it's only gotten worse. So I just feel like we need real people, humble, moral, and truthful leaders, and we need to come together on issues like that everybody wants, which is safety for our communities, education for our students, and our children.
I love the idea, and I take it you'd follow maybe in the model that Arizona's done, where they say if a parent or parents want to take their child out of conventional government schools, that when that child leaves and goes to a private school or a charter school or any other kind of school, that some of the money or all of the money follows that child. That would allow a lot of parents to make choices instead of simply taking the one-size-fits-all and failing government model.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's time for Oregon to separate from trying to federalize education here. It's time to revamp our Oregon Department of Education. It's time to put parents back in the driver's seat and honor parents' rights. And it's time to really do right by our citizens and our students. They are not learning. Right now they're being politicized with progressive agendas, and they're being made to consider what their gender is when it's not even a developmentally appropriate topic for them to be focusing on. We need to get the academics back in school, and we need to make sure parents are there. And that brings me to the Oregon Health Authority. They are taking public comment because they still have some administrative rules that are in place, and that is keeping parents out of the classroom, and it's requiring masks, and it's requiring vaccination. So these are things that we need everybody to write into the OHA. The due date for that is September 30th. That's this Friday.
Have you figured out, I'm talking to Kim Rice, who's running as the Republican candidate in Senate District 18. Have you figured out why they have all those mandates in place when they're being dropped left and right? Even in places like New York has dropped a lot of its vaccine mandates. Canada has now dropped its vaccine mandates at the border. I mean, they're dropping left and right, but for some reason, Oregon officials have hung on to those things.
Well, Lars, it's nothing to do with our health. It's all about control. And right now, we need people like me running to put rights back to the people. We need our government lessened. We need this control, this nanny state of these unelected officials with a $29 billion biennial budget. We need them done. So I'm running as one of the people to bring common sense back. And I really do hope, no matter who we have as governor, that we are able to flip our legislature and get some reasonable leadership in to Salem. And that's why I'm here on your show, because I need people to know I am running against people that have huge union money behind them or personal funding. And I don't think the money should be the only reason why somebody gets elected. We need people that are going to work hard, and that's what I've been doing. If you didn't know, I stood against the mandates in October last year. I saw what Kate Brown was going to do to healthcare workers and school workers, and she took me out of my 27-year career, my passion. And I said to myself, I am not done helping my children and families. I am going forth, and I am going to work outside the classroom, and I'm going to help Oregonians because I love this state. I am not leaving it. I'm here to fight. I am a doer. I'm a relator, and I've got lots of Democrats already voting for me. They have told me so.
Well, that's good. Where can people find you on social media?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, Kim Rice for Oregon. I'm also at KimRiceForOregon.com and Instagram, Kim for Oregon. Those are three places you can find me.
Can I ask you out of curiosity, who do you plan to back for governor?
I'm going to go with Christine Drazen, and I'll tell you why, Lars. She stands more conservatively in alignment with me as a strong conservative Republican. Just looking at some of the different things she's voted on. I mean, I definitely want to repeal the cat tax. She voted no on that. She does not support critical race theory, and neither do I, because I've seen how it's tearing our families apart. They call it social and emotional learning or diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice. But no, she's in alignment with my beliefs. We need a better chance for people to live in Oregon. Too many people have fled the state.
Absolutely right. Kim, I've got to break it off. We're up against hard break. That's KimRiceForOregon.com. Back in just a moment. I'll get to your calls, and I'll tell you a crazy story about a teenager who says she's the face of climate activism until she's called on her fancy vacation. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers, you always go right to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you have a moment, vote in our Twitter poll. We put up a brand new question written out of the news of the day every single day, and we put it up two places. because I'm one of those that's not crazy about Twitter, and I know that some of you are as well. And if we had the technological capability, not us, but the social media sites had the ability, we'd move it to Truth Social or to Getter or to Parler or some other location. But for now, it's on Twitter until we get the capability to move it elsewhere. Again, as I said, that's not in our hands. That's in the hands of the social media giants. But you can vote on our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show. And if you don't like Twitter, go to my website, and that's LarsLarson.com. I have to tell you that there's something that really gets under my skin. And it's these cute little climate activists out there. And by that, I mean usually teenage young men and women. I mean, they're not of age yet, but they're activists. And I have no problem with teenagers being activists. The problem I have is a lot of the climate activists come out and they clearly know nothing about the subject. They say we should be in a world where people don't use automobiles and we don't burn diesel and gasoline. And I know to a fair certainty most of these kids are coming from a household where they live in a house made out of wood cut from trees. When they use the toilet, they use toilet paper that's made from trees. They eat food that came to a grocery store in a refrigerated truck, and the truck was driven by diesel. And I also suspect that since a lot of the kids who've chosen to be climate activists, because it's so popular, people like Greta Thunberg and others, almost every state has a bunch of teenagers who all say, we're filing a federal court case and we're going to go in and demand that the government fix the climate crisis right now, as though it's something that could be fixed by just a judge saying, make that change. So anyway, it bothers me because when I've had the opportunity to talk to some of these teenage climate activists, and you ask them any questions about the subject, they don't know much about it. They just know that it's really, really popular. They get a lot of public attention. They get their face on the front of the Daily Dead Fish wrapper on TV or on radio. And everybody cuts them slack and says, well, you know, they're teenagers. You have to. No, I don't want to encourage them to talk about things about which they know nothing. And I don't want to talk to them about, or I don't want them to be out being activists on things in which, in many cases, they are hypocrites. So I heard part of an interview, one of my great producers, Mackenzie Prunty, found this, a 16-year-old climate activist in New Zealand. And she goes on this radio show, News Talk ZB, and the host is Heather Duplessis Allen. And she went on last Friday. And there are two parts to this that I want to play for you. I want to play part one so you get an idea. And this young lady is talking to the radio host about her climate activism and all the things she's doing to make sure that she saves planet Earth. Play part one, please.
So we would have to apply to have like approved events to be able to fly for.
Well, that's one thing that you could look at doing.
Am I allowed to go to Fiji? Is that necessary?
In the current climate crisis, I don't think that that's necessary.
When was the last time you were on a plane?
I'm not sure. Maybe a few months ago, to be honest.
Where'd you go?
Fiji.
Izzy! Izzy!
Now, I got to tell you something. Fiji has one main industry, and it's tourism. I've never been to Fiji. Would I like to go to Fiji sometime? Yes. Have I ever been there? No. Do I ever think there's much likelihood I'll go to Fiji? Probably not. But you go there to have fun. Now, this young lady is telling the radio host, we have to stop flying on airplanes. Well, are you still flying on airplanes? Well, yes. And where are you going? To a place where the only reason to go there, it's not for business, it's not for education, it's to go and sit on the beach and drink a cold drink and have fun. So then the radio host really bores down on this young lady, Izzy Cook. Take a listen to part two.
Don't you care about the climate, Izzy?
Of course I care about the climate.
Not enough. You went to... Fiji. Izzy, come on, mate. Are you serious? Are you serious, Izzy?
No, it's pretty ironic.
Are you still there?
It is pretty ironic, but to be honest, it's not really a trip that I wanted to go on, but I can't really get out of it.
Why'd you go? Why'd you go? Because
my parents wanted to go.
Izzy!
I didn't want to go.
How are you embarrassed that your parents did that to the planet and then forced you to do it as well?
Of course I'm not embarrassed.
Did you have a terrible time?
Not really. I didn't have a
good time. Izzy, I'm sorry. Mate, listen, You're such a champion. I think you've got a brilliant future ahead of you. And are you doing another strike soon?
Yeah, we'll look to.
Good. I will talk to you again when I get you back on the show.
Now, this is the joke that this young lady tells everybody else, you can't fly on planes. But she goes to a place and even admits she had a good time because she was there on vacation. Well, my parents made me go. That would be like, and if my parents were still alive and I said, well, my parents made me go to Hawaii. And yeah, I had a horrible, but nobody else should fly on airplanes. You know what happened after that interview? Over the weekend, the mother of Izzy Cook, the 16-year-old climate activist, got angry and wrote this opinion piece saying the radio host should be ashamed for bullying her daughter. Friday evening, I listened in horror as my 16-year-old daughter had a phone conversation with somebody who appeared to be bullying her, laughing at her and talking over her. As soon as she got off the call, I demanded to know who the hell was speaking to my child this way. So this is a mother who apparently has no problem getting on an airplane and going for a family vacation in Fiji. And if her daughter was not a climate activist, I'd say, good, good for you. I'm glad your family can travel off to exotic places, although I suspect for people in New Zealand, it's a lot closer, so not nearly as exotic as it would be for, say, somebody here in the United States. And she says these commentators don't give a blank about climate change. They don't care about Arctic ice melting at four times the expected rate. In other words, the mother is getting on her bully pulpit, the same mother who joined a family vacation flying thousands of miles to go to Fiji so they could sit on the beach and drink cool drinks and go out to dinner and do all these things that are way out of the reach of almost everybody on planet Earth, almost everybody, and get on her high horse in high dudgeon and say, how dare you treat my daughter that way? Well, you know what? If you decide to become a climate activist, people should take that as an invitation to ask you tough questions about your position. To say, do you really actually live this way? Or are you just interested in telling everybody else how to live their lives? You shouldn't drive cars, but I do. You shouldn't use fossil fuels, but I do. Yeah, this is why I'm always curious when some of these teenage activists, even in my neck of the woods, have decided to file federal lawsuits. I have asked time and again to get them on the show to ask them, do you actually live this in your own life? Do you live in a 1,000-square-foot house or a 5,000-square-foot house? Do you go on vacation by flying on planes? Do you drive a car? Do you do all the other things that you want to tell the rest of us not to do? Well, then how dare you? How dare you be the hypocrite who tells everybody else how to live their lives, because you are the perfect model of people like John Kerry, Joe Biden's climate czar, who tells everybody else, we've got to save the planet, as he's climbing on his private jet to jet off to another part of the world to be the gas bag he truly is and give another speech, because that's worth thousands of gallons of aviation fuel. In any case, glad to get your calls and naysayer calls as well. We welcome them right here on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, that is, you disagree with my point of view, we're glad to welcome you, and not only welcome you, but put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. If you want to send an email, talk at LarsLarson.com. Have no fear, they all come to me and not to anybody else. And if you want to vote in our Twitter poll, our daily question from the news of the day, just go to @LarsLarsonShow on Twitter. And if you're like me and don't like Twitter, go to my website at LarsLarson.com. Your vote counts the same. Now, there have been revolutions in this world that have been touched off by what seem at the moment relatively minor things. In fact, just a few years ago in the Middle East, there was a man who was selling vegetables, and he was stopped by a female cop, and that was significant for the Middle East, and she wrote him up, said, you can't sell these vegetables, you have to have a permit. And he didn't have the money for the permit, so he was so distraught, he poured gasoline on himself and set himself on fire, and that helped touch off a revolution. At this point, there may be something similar going on in the country of Iran, and I knew I needed to get the bottom line on this, so we called Russell Berman, who's the Walter Haas Professor in Humanities at Stanford, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and co-chair of the Working Group on the Middle East and the Islamic World. Professor Berman, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I'll tell you that I was frustrated during Obama's years that there seemed to be an awful lot of especially younger Iranians who wanted to have a change in their country, and they tried to get it by going to the streets, and they got, you know, kind of the cold shoulder from Barack Obama. Are we seeing a similar opportunity today in Iran because of a woman who was killed in police custody because of the way she was dressed?
Unfortunately, the Biden administration is replicating the Obama administration's disregard for the democratic protests in Iran. In 2009, I believe it was, President Obama did not speak out forcefully in defense of the significant protests against the Mullah regime in Tehran. And now we're witnessing something similar. Just 2 weeks ago, a young Iranian woman was arrested, brutalized, and killed because she did not wear her headscarf correctly. The morality police took her into custody, and she never came out again alive. What is remarkable is that this has sparked 2 weeks of significant demonstrations across Iran with women taking off their hijab, their headscarf, burning it, calling for the death of the Raisi and of Khamenei, the leaders of Iran. Will this touch off a revolution? We don't know. But I certainly wish that the Biden administration were more forceful in its response. Of course, it's condemned pro forma the killing of the young woman, but it should be breaking off the Iran negotiations, the Iran deal negotiations that continue despite the lack of success. There should be a much more forceful condemnation of what's going on than what we're seeing.
Well, and Professor Berman, isn't the, you know, you said the standard condemnation. It sounds like the strongly worded letter that all of us ridiculed is the idea of, okay, we'll officially take a position. We're not in favor of you beating young ladies to death because they're wearing their headscarves, but we're not going to go beyond that. That's all the Biden administration is doing right now.
Well, let's put this in some context, because in addition to the tragedy of Mahsa Amini, that's the name of the woman who was killed by the morality police in Iran, we have in recent weeks witnessed assassination attempts by Iranian agents on an Iranian-American woman who is a dissident and a strong critic of the regime. This is Mahsa Alinja, who lives in Brooklyn, and Iranian agents have come to her door with weapons and in the hope of assassinating her. And in addition, we had the assassination attempt, the Iran-inspired assassination attempt of the famous author Salman Rushdie. All of this is coming out of Iran. It's not clear to me why. Well, it's shameful that the Biden administration is not more forceful in its condemnation of what Iran is doing.
Although, Professor, I'm kind of tempted to throw into that context you offered up, not in counterpoint to it, but here in America, last Friday, a Catholic man who likes to go to abortion clinics and protest with his 12-year-old son, and a year ago, he got into a little shoving scuffle, but nothing more than that. Joe Biden's FBI had 25 to 30 agents show up at his house, armed with guns drawn, to arrest this guy for having, you know, basically voiced his opinion, even though America has a First Amendment and Iran does not. So that's a piece of context about this administration as well.
You're right. That is a piece of context. The politicization of the FBI, like before, the politicization of the IRS. These are warning signs for our democracy. President Biden talks about the threat to democracy. He should understand that the biggest threat to democracy is in his own administration.
Yeah, and let's go back to the Middle East, though. Is it as simple, because I tend to view things in simple terms, but is it as simple as the fact that Joe Biden is so desperate to get back to the Barack Obama style deal with Iran, even though Iran doesn't seem to have been moving much? They're calling the shots, and we're negotiating through the Russians, believe it or not, with Iran over getting some nuclear deal. It doesn't even seem all that meaningful anymore. But Joe Biden is so anxious to get that deal that he's willing to let this whole movement simply fade away.
Very few people think this deal is still going to come through. It might yet still. The point is that President Biden is holding on to the image of this deal because he doesn't want to break with the Obama legacy. I think something else is at stake, though. The question is, why is it that Democratic administrations are soft on Iran? And I think they're soft on Iran in general because Iran is a revolutionary regime, and that's where the sympathies of the Democratic establishment lie.
Why? Why are they sympathetic to a revolutionary regime, especially a regime that you remember when you know, nobody, there were a lot of bad things about the Shah, but the Shah was westernizing that country, you know, decades ago. When the Khomeini came in, he said, I'm going to make the streets run red with blood. And he not just figuratively, but literally did. It's a terrible regime. It's a state sponsor of terrorism, according to the U.S. State Department. It's an evil country. Why do they want to side with a bunch of evildoers?
I think that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is fundamentally sympathetic to the Iranian Revolution, just like I think that the core of the conservative Republican Party is more or less sympathetic to the conservative monarchies of the Middle East. It's as simple as that.
Wow. So where do we go at this point, and what could Americans do who disagree with our current regime, the Biden regime, do to try to help the Iranians and say, we'd like to see you bring about change in your country if that's what you desire, because we did that a couple of hundred years ago right here.
Well, what can Americans do realistically in the face of the news from Iran? You know, write to your newspapers, write to your congresspeople, say that the United States should be more forceful in condemning the Iranian regime, say that we should cut off the JCPOA negotiations as long as it's going on, demand that the killers of Mahsa Amini are brought to justice. Secretary of State Blinken said that this administration would put human rights front and center in American foreign policy. This is a human rights issue. Where's Secretary Blinken?
You would think, because even among other things, I guess young ladies who are attending end of term parties, you know, you finish school and you get to have a little party, they're being beaten and fined as well. And here's Anthony Blinken and Joe Biden not doing much about it. Professor Berman, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks so very much.
Enjoyed talking. Till next.
Thank you, sir. That's Russell Berman. He's at Stanford University, professor of humanities. He's also at the Hoover Institution and co-chair of the Working Group on the Middle East and the Islamic World. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show. Coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network, you know all those folks they called crazy for worrying that the COVID vaccination might affect your reproductive cycle? Well, guess what? A Northwest medical institution has come up with the statistics and the proof of it. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. This segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showing, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Our Twitter poll today, is it time to repeal Measure 110, Oregon's de facto legalization of hard drugs? I've had a few arguments with callers about this. I said, look, it's de facto legalization. What do you mean by that? They're not legal. They're still illegal. I said, yes, they're still illegal. But it's like a Montana speeding ticket. If you are caught with hard drugs, up to a 30-day supply of the hardest drugs around, heroin, cocaine, methamphetamine, even fentanyl, which is not mentioned in Measure 110, but is effectively legalized by the limits they put on the cops. And you say, well, they can still write you a ticket. Yes, they can write you a $100 ticket. And you don't even have to pay the ticket if you make a phone call to a counseling service and they say, would you like to go into treatment? And last year, they wrote about 16,000 of these tickets. And do you know how many people went into treatment? Zero, which is why some of the experts out there, Keith Humphreys is a guy who's an expert in his field in prevention and treatment of addiction. He actually testified to Oregon lawmakers and said the state's drug policy encourages drug use and has no deterrence. Quote, addicted people usually do not seek treatment and recovery without external pressure from family, friends, employers, healthcare providers, or the law. Why does this matter? It matters because Oregon has removed all legal pressure to stop drug use and seek treatment. Because many addicted people are not working or not in touch with their family, those pressures to stop using drugs and alcohol are absent from their lives. And Measure 110 took away the last incentive, the one where a judge says, I can find you guilty of a felony, you'll go to prison, you'll end up with this on your record, or you can go into treatment. That actually turned out to be a great incentive for people to go into treatment. I think it's time to repeal Measure 110. Now, should we ask the voters again? Absolutely. And if the voters say no, then the voters will have the blood on their hands of all of the people out there who have overdosed on these drugs. And also the blood on their hands because drug trafficking, and you know this, some of you live in neighborhoods where there are shootings on a regular basis, shell casings scattered all over the street, because the drug gangs compete for territory. And they don't compete the way we do out here in the real world. They compete with guns and violence. So you want to vote for more of that? Go ahead. To your calls now. Let's go to Pete. Hey, Pete, thanks for listening in Happy Valley on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, Larson, thanks. Thanks for calling. Hey, listen, I'm here in Oregon now for almost, in America, almost 40 years, 25 in Oregon. Now, all this time, Oregonians, you're voting, they have no chance that to change anything. So we're voting for the same thing over and over and over, and the idea that something will change, that is insanity. That is insanity. These people, agreed. the other two candidates, they are in the program, they are on the, whatever they do, they don't do nothing for the state. Look where we are. When I came to Oregon 25 years ago, Lars, this was a beautiful state. I mean, you know, we all know. And now, these people, they drag it into the garbage can. Now, do Americans in Oregon wants to have the same thing for the next 4 years? You answer that.
No. I don't think they do. I think they'd tell you generically, we don't want this. But again, if they vote for the same thing, and what I've told people, Betsy Johnson's a friend of mine. I consider her a friend. But I say I don't choose who I'd like to see in office based on friendship. I choose it based on policy. And in the policy choices, I see Tina Kotek as more of the Kate Brown disaster, only on steroids. And I see Betsy Johnson as a former Democrat who will go along with the Democrats in the legislature that she's sure to be saddled with, because we're still likely to have a strong Democrat majority in the House and the Senate. So is Betsy Johnson going to sit in the governor's office and veto almost everything that comes in front of her? I don't think so. I think she will say, well, I have to work with these people. Whereas I think Christine Drazen, Drazen will still have to deal with a Democrat legislature, but at least she comes at it from a pro-life point of view and a pro-gun point of view. Betsy Johnson has softened up considerably on her gun position, sad to say.
And the state of Oregon will have a chance to say, hey, give this gal a chance. Give her a chance after 40 years. Give him a chance, you know, because this definitely, definitely does not work. This is insanity.
Absolutely right. Pete, thanks for the call. I mentioned this study. So a lot of us asked, well, what about the side effects of these vaccinations? Oh, they're perfectly safe, even though they weren't tested very well at all. In fact, the latest booster was tested on a few mice, not even on human beings. Consider this, though. A study done, and one of the people involved, Allison Edelman, is a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at Oregon Health and Science University. She led the study. I would love to talk to Dr. Edelman. I'll make the phone calls, but OHSU is not usually very forthcoming. They did a study of 20,000 people, and they said, does the vaccine, not COVID, but the vaccine, have an effect on women's menstrual periods? And the answer is yes. They just published the study yesterday in the British Medical Journal. And what they found is they found among the 14,000 participants who had been vaccinated and almost 5,000 who had not, turned out there were some fairly large differences in women's menstrual cycles. And nobody can explain exactly why. And they said for some of the women, it actually changed their cycles as much as 4 days, and in some cases, delays of 8 days or more. Again, I'd love to get you more details from the young lady who's involved in the site. We'll ask for the interview and see what happens. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Oregon Utility Notification Center wants to remind you that whether you're planting a tree, building a fence, or just making improvements around your farm or home, click or call before you start your work to get the area marked. Then dig safely and avoid contact with buried utilities. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones. Know what's below. Call before you dig. For more information, visit us online at digsafelyoregon.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, the states of the Northwest, for the past 22 and a half years. I'm glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And if you want to vote in our Twitter poll, you can find that question at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. The question is it time to repeal Measure 110, that's Oregon's de facto legalization of hard drugs. And I would tag on to that as a subset of that. I'd love to see the state of Washington and the legislature in Olympia decide to go back and put hard drugs back on the law books. But that's going to take action by the legislature. The courts took them off. I'd love to see the legislature put them back on, because Oregon's example has been absolutely disastrous. Our number of overdose deaths has gone up dramatically. And why? They say, well, we offered treatment. In fact, they offered about $250 million worth of treatment. That's how much they budgeted to take money from the marijuana taxes and spend it on drug treatment. The problem is nobody's signing up for it. You know, that was the idea, that if you just wrote a ticket to somebody who's caught with hard drugs. And now the police have almost no incentive to catch people, because all they can do is write a ticket. And the ticket has a $100 fine that's forgivable if you simply make one phone call and talk to somebody about maybe having treatment. They did that a lot last year, 16,000 times, and got no takers. No, none. So that's how crazy this is. Is it time to repeal Measure 110, Oregon's de facto legalization of hard drugs? You can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Yesterday's poll question: should teachers get raises when student test scores are falling? 90% of you agreed with me and said no, but 10% of you said, yeah, go ahead, give them a raise, even though the product they're producing is demonstrably worse. To your calls now at 866-439-5277. Let's go first to Nick, listening on the Radio Northwest Network in Bend and KBND. How you doing, Nick?
Good, Lars. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to kind of bring a point with that gal that broke into some lady's house and went to bed on her children's bed, putting lives in danger. You know, along with that, Ben, a couple of years ago, had an ADA that left their infant child in the car for something like 5 hours. No charges were filed against that individual. It was an accident, a little slap on the wrist, and that was it. You know, along with the, you know, this Measure 110 stuff, the world is simple to fix. It's all about accountability, Lars. We need to go back to having morals, simplify everything. Accountability is key, and no one's holding anybody accountable. No one has any morals, no one has any common sense, and no one has any logic. And when are people going to open their eyes and notice that? It's just pathetic.
Well, I don't disagree with anything you just said, because it's what we talk about on this show. And one of the worst reasons for the lack of accountability, and the one we're getting a lot these days, is the question of, we can't punish people for doing that, because when we do, we end up with too many people of color being punished. And you say, why is that a problem? Are they doing the crime? Yes. Are you applying the law equally to everybody without regard to color? Yes. Well, then apply the law. Well, no, then we arrest too many people of color. And literally the schools, that question I ask about the teachers and the raises, I heard from the father or his father or mother of a teacher yesterday who said, you don't understand, my daughter can't teach because her classroom is in chaos. I said, then have her labor union demand, like they demand other things, demand that there be accountability, that when kids get out of line, that they see swift punishment that sends a message, don't get out of line. And so the lack of accountability is for the same reason. The schools all kept saying, well, you know, when we punish kids based on the rules, we punish too many black and brown kids. You say, so what? Are you applying the rule to everybody without regard to what color they are? Yes. Well, then apply the rule. I mean, this would be like saying we shouldn't lock people up in prison because 90% of the people sitting in state prison today are men and only 10% are women. Well, any knucklehead would tell you, well, that's because men commit more crimes than women do. You say, no, it must be because of sexism. Nobody would buy that nonsense. And yet the schools run that way. The legislatures run that way. They say we can't do this because it'll apply to too many of one group or another. And we want to show that we're being abundantly fair. Well, being fair to people also leads to people dying, unfortunately. But I agree with everything you just said. Let's go to a naysayer. How about Greg? Greg, we love the naysayers. Thanks for calling. What do you and I disagree about today?
Mostly, I just think that the whole drug thing, as far as making the drugs legal and you wanted to make them, I guess, illegal again.
Yes.
That you were talking about.
Yes.
And I don't know. I just find that when they're illegal, it just causes a lot of problems. I think it gives more power to the cartels when drugs are illegal. I think that the drugs are not as safe as they could be if when they're illegal.
What? Hold on. You're saying we could have safe heroin and safe fentanyl and safe methamphetamine. You're going to have to explain that one to me.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even in the medical field, which I work in, I mean, they use fentanyl and they use it.
Yeah, but they use it under a doctor's care. When somebody uses it as a party drug, which is the way it's used right now, that cannot be safe. If you had a patient come to you and say, hey, I'd like you to give me some fentanyl that I can take whenever I feel like I'm in pain and I need to take it, would you give them a bottle of pills and say, go ahead, do this under your own supervision. I'm sure you'll be okay. Would you do that?
Well, it's the same thing as alcohol, though. I mean,
No. Answer my question. Would it be safe to send a patient home to self-dose on fentanyl?
If they know the dosing and you know exactly what you're getting so that it can be within safe range, yeah, you could.
If they really follow, but does any medical, you say you work in medicine. What kind of job do you do in medicine?
I'm a medical translator.
You're a medical translator, so you translate documents. Yeah. You're not really directly involved in medicine, are you?
Well, actually, I work directly with many different specialists, and I have to have a medical background in order to work with them.
I understand, but you're not involved in direct patient care. You're translating documents. So it's nice to add in that you're in the field of medicine, but only sort of on the fringes. But has any clinic you've ever worked with ever sent people home, not with a fentanyl patch that doses it out, but with a bottle full of pills and say, go ahead, take as many as you think you need. We'll trust you to get the dosage right.
Well, no, because I think you're kind of going about it the wrong way as far as understanding the argument. What I'm saying is if drugs are legal, people can, again, just like tobacco, just like alcohol, even like cannabis in a lot of places, if it's legal, you can make sure that it's made properly and people know the dosing. When people overdose on fentanyl, a lot of times they don't know what they're getting. And when drugs are illegal, that's what happens.
You know, yeah, well, those drugs are still technically illegal. But what happens is the one lever they had to encourage people to seek treatment was saying, if you don't, there's a criminal penalty. And they took that away, and now nobody in that crowd is seeking treatment, sad to say. Greg, good naysayer in any case. When we come back, Joe Biden isn't only causing inflation of gas and groceries. Now there's inflation in the cost of trafficking human beings. That and your phone calls coming up next. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Now, if you think you've got it bad, because of the Joe Bidenflation that's going on, the inflation that has taken gas prices up over 50% higher than they were the day that Joe Biden took the oath of office. Grocery prices are up 13.5%, the biggest increase in grocery prices since Jimmy Carter, the former worst president in American history. And now we've got Joe Biden, who's worse still. But inflation has apparently also hit the human smuggling business. They estimate the value of human smuggling on the U.S.-Mexico border at $20 billion, and they say the cartels have done very, very well in during Joe Biden's term in office. The cartels have made $2.6 billion in profit over the last 12 months from controlling the routes that illegal aliens use. It's apparently up dramatically. The Washington Times reports that they have a database of smuggling cases. Mexican migrants are now paying an average of $8,600 to get smuggled across the border. That's one person across the border. That is up $2,000, or about 30% since 2019, the last pre-pandemic year under the Trump administration. If you're coming here from El Salvador, Honduras, or Guatemala, they're paying $11,500 for that trip, up from about $9,000 in 2020 and $7,800 in 2019. So apparently Joe Biden has been very good for cartel business. I wonder if his son, you know, the smartest guy he knows, I wonder if his son is making out like a bandit too. Let's go to Harry Dozier, who is a 16th District Washington State Senator. How are you doing, Senator?
I'm doing very well, Lars. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
I'm glad to do it. You called in when I was talking about this crazy Measure 110 that was passed by voters and had de facto legalization of hard drugs. And now even the experts in the treatment field are saying, this is nuts. You got to repeal this thing.
Yeah, absolutely right. Lars, I don't know if you're familiar with the Blake decision in Washington State that passed the Supreme Court. Yes.
Yep.
So this led to some legislation that was passed 2 years ago because of that decision to basically carve the way for these illegal drugs to eventually be legal. So in the state Senate, we were able to work to have it through the process to have it be a gross misdemeanor, but it went to the House and the House brings it back out with just a misdemeanor. And so right now, if we don't do something here, I believe it's this year in 2023, it will refer back to just making personal amounts of illegal drugs legal. And this is where we're headed, is basically where Oregon is right now.
Yeah, and see, when you say personal amounts, that's one of those tricky little catchphrases, because personal amounts in Oregon mean you could effectively have up to a 30-day supply. And they say, well, that's a personal amount. Like most people probably have a 30-day supply of toilet paper in their house. The problem is when you're talking about heroin, it effectively makes it legal for the drug dealers to run around with a supply they can sell as long as they never carry more than a certain amount, which is considered to be a personal use amount, which I think it seems like such a transparent legalization of drug dealing that I almost can't believe it.
No, and that's where we headed with this whole bill, as it was moving forward. When we saw the list of drugs that were on there for personal use, it was unbelievable. Even the date rape drug that they were talking about, you could have on your own person. Now, who is going to ingest that themselves with a date rape drug? No. They're going to use it for illegal purposes. This was absolutely crazy. So I don't know. I believe it's this year it's going to come back up again, and we have to address it and hopefully take care of it.
Well, but let me ask you this. When you take it back to a gross misdemeanor, the key part of this for is that over the years I've had prosecutors tell me, and it seems to be borne out by experience, that if you tell somebody arrested for hard drugs, a user, if you say you have a choice, you can go into treatment or you can get a felony conviction, that a great number of people will simply say, OK, I'll take treatment. I'll try to stay on the wagon. And if the judge says, and if you keep your nose clean, literally and figuratively in that case, for a year, I'll wipe out the felony conviction. You'll be able to go without a record and you won't go to prison. That's worked very well to get people into treatment. Is a gross misdemeanor going to do the trick there?
I believe the gross misdemeanor with the process that they went through would have required treatment at some point within that, depending on how many times that you were arrested. I cannot totally remember the...
That sounds awfully soft, Senator. Senator, that sounds awfully soft. It sounds like you're going to... Even the fixed piece of legislation sounds like you're going to put yourself in Oregon's boat, where effectively there's no punishment, which means there's no incentive to go to treatment. And this is despite the fact that Oregon allocated almost $250 million for treatment. Now, they were incompetent at actually getting it shoveled out into the clinics and all. And some of them appear to be giving the money to people who don't know anything about treating people for drugs. But if last year Oregon wrote 16,000 tickets and didn't get a single taker to go into treatment, you know, this idea, this Pollyanna idea, that somehow if you offer treatment, the guy or gal on heroin or meth or cocaine or whatever is going to say, oh, I was just waiting for somebody to offer me treatment. I'd be glad to kick my habit. They're not doing that.
No, but we couldn't get a felony out of it. We tried to get a felony out of it, and the majority party would not bargain on a felony. So the best we could get was to be able to get a gross misdemeanor. And well, so that's what we worked with. If we hadn't been able to get the gross misdemeanor, the whole thing would have just gone back to the Blake decision. So we were able to get that out of the Senate with the Senate bill. Then it went on to the House, and then the House watered it down to just a misdemeanor.
Senator, you're able to call witnesses when they're having a hearing on these things. Can't, if you called up some of the judges who sat in what they call drug court and offered people that choice, felony or treatment, would any of those judges get behind the idea that without the proper lever, you're not going to get people into treatment? And would they testify to that effect in Olympia?
Well, I would have hoped so. I don't sit on that committee, Lars, so I really can't speak about that, exactly what was done with it. I was only a part of what was the discussion on the floor. But obviously, I think so. I mean, I can go back to when I was a Walla Walla County Commissioner, when we chose not to allow growing and the sale of marijuana in the unincorporated areas of Walla Walla because of the testimony from people that we had heard on that is a gateway drug to harder drugs. So we did not allow that then. This is very similar, but not being on that committee that recommended this and brought that bill forward, I cannot speak in depth about it, Lars.
And by the way, for the next time you have that conversation, Senator, you do know that there are some great studies from solid medical journals that say that even smoking of the average grade of pot today, which is not your grandma's pot from the 70s, yeah, dramatically increases the occurrence of psychosis. And I'm, you know, people say, well, that's crazy, Lars. You're just anti-marijuana. I said, if it increases dramatically the number of people who are psychotic, do you think that might be an explanation for why we have so many crazy people who are living on the streets of, you know, Portland, Seattle, Spokane, and Tri-Cities and everywhere else? Because they say, oh, pot, it's harmless. It's no big deal. Except it makes a certain percentage of people psychotic. And you've legalized the drug, so it's not just a gateway drug. It might just drive you crazy in the meantime, and then you'll end up living on the streets and assaulting people. Senator Dozier, thanks so much. I appreciate the call. Nice when we get a state senator to call in. Glad to have you with me. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails here in just a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Naysayers go to the head of the line. And, of course, vote in our Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show. And if you don't like Twitter like me, go to my website, LarsLarson.com. I've been looking forward to talking to Peter Navarro again. Dr. Peter Navarro, as I should call him, former assistant to President Trump. He was there from the beginning all the way to the end, director of trade and industrial policy for the White House, and the author of a new book called Taking Back Trump's America, Why We Lost the White House and How We'll Win It Back. Doctor, it's a pleasure to have you back on the show.
You know, great to be with you, Lars. I remember, if I've got this right, back in 2016, talking to you close to the November 8th election for President Trump that he won, and talking about what it meant to be a Trump Republican. And you fast forward now, this book, Taking Back Trump's America, it's not really a book for me, it's a mission. We have a country and an economy that is in chaos right now. The economy is collapsing. We're fighting inflation. It's eroding wages, making it impossible for people to live. The financial markets are being crushed. We lost literally trillions of dollars of wealth in this country. We got an invasion on our southern border. And, of course, Putin and Xi Jinping of China are roaming free to do their mischief. And it's all because elections have consequences. It's all because Pelosi, Schumer, and Biden are in charge and doing seemingly everything possibly wrong for this country. So Taking Back Trump's America is really the blueprint and battle cry for the MAGA movement, not just to get Trump back in the White House in 2024, but most immediately in the next less than 40 days get Nancy Pelosi the hell out of the speaker's chair in Congress so that we can at least stop hemorrhaging all the problems we're hemorrhaging now.
I couldn't agree with you more. So tell me this. You mentioned Joe Biden being in charge. Do you think he's really calling the shots as incompetent as he seems to many of us just watching from when on those rare occasions he shows up in front of cameras like he did and says, where's Jackie? Meaning Jackie Walorski, the member of Congress who was killed in a car wreck 2 months ago. This is a president who doesn't remember even things like that. And he doesn't seem to be all there upstairs. So is he really calling the shots? Or is it Barack Obama from his Georgetown house, or what?
I think most likely the president of this country right now is Ron Klain, the Biden chief of staff, and maybe Jill with a little bit of advice, God help us all, from Hunter Biden, who Joe Biden, by the way, called the smartest person he'd ever met. You put your finger on the pulse of something. The problem here, Lars, is that Biden was with Obama for 8 long years, and they trained a large number of bureaucrats in the deep swamp to learn how to effectively govern in terms of getting things done. The problem we face right now, Lars, is that everything they're getting done quickly is wrong for the American people. Everything. I mean, if you break down kind of the stagflation issue, you got recession and inflation all at the same time. In the Taking Back Trump's America book, I have a chapter about a memo I wrote in 2020, September, warning precisely of this looming stagflation crisis. Now, keep in mind, that was 3 years ago. And I could see coming, because of the breakdown of our global supply chains, this buildup of cost push inflation. So we've got that in spades now. And on top of that, we're overstimulating the economy with Keynesian stimulus, which is fueling inflation, with these trillion-dollar bills on Capitol Hill that are really misplaced. And the forced vax policy decimated our labor markets. Everything he does. And by the way, buried the lead here. It's a great story in Taking Back Trump's America about how I work with the White House legal counsel and President Trump to seal that border down south. That border right now is a sieve. There's over 2 million illegal aliens at a minimum that have come over since Biden took office. And that not only puts downward pressure on wages and employment opportunities for black, brown, and blue-collar Americans, it burdens our schools, burdens our emergency rooms, and it causes everybody's taxes to go up as we have to subsidize that illegal immigration. So this just, I mean, look, the people listening to this show, if you're angry, good. If you're frustrated, bad. Don't be frustrated. What you need to do is find a couple of races, either in your state or around the country, where they will help take back Trump's America. You know, there's a Senate race in Arizona, Blake Masters. Help him
out.
Very
important.
Mitch McConnell, a rhino, certainly isn't, but that could be the key to the majority. There's House races around the country. I love one in Iowa 3. Zach Nunn, a Republican, is running against an incumbent, Sidney Axne. Axne is my mantra. You know, you could just go to somebody's website like Zach Nunn, send him a few bucks. The word is action, action, action. That's the culture of the Taking Back Trump's America book, and that's what I urge you listeners to do.
Let me ask you about this. I'm talking to Peter Navarro, author most recently of Taking Back Trump's America, Why We Lost the White House and How We'll Win It Back. The deep state that Donald Trump talked about, that most of the mainstream media just simply denied the existence of it, but it even existed within the White House, and you identify some of the bad guys, including the president's son-in-law.
Yes, there's the old Reagan rule that personnel is policy, meaning that if a president has the wrong personnel around him that doesn't abide by his vision, he'll get the wrong policy. Well, that played out in spades in the Trump White House, at least early in the administration.
And I coined the refinement that bad personnel is not just bad policy, but bad politics. And this part of the story of taking back Trump's America is how sappers within the West Wing itself created a set of strategic failures that led to an election which I think should have been a landslide but was made close enough to steal. And some of the people I mentioned include Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. I mean, if he had never darkened the door of the Oval, the boss might be there just with him alone. That guy did so much damage. But Kushner failed on many fronts, but probably the worst mistake was how he ran the 2020 campaign. In Taking Back Trump's America, I go back to the beautiful 2016 campaign, 20 people on an airplane, 100 people like me in the Trump Tower War Room in Manhattan. Every nickel counted, and we got it done. Kushner was given the largest budget in a presidential election history. We spent more overall than Joe Biden. But as I relate in one chapter in Taking Back Trump's America, Kushner was like a monkey with a flamethrower burning cash. There's a great story about Peter Thiel, a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, who wrote a check for $250,000 to the campaign. That's a lot of money. Well, guess what? That money got spent in January, 10 months before the election, to pay for a mere 2 seconds of a 30-second Super Bowl ad. I mean, it was insane. And Lars, when we were like a few weeks out from Election Day, we had to pull our ads in key states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, and Biden actually outspent us in the last 2 months of the election. You can't do that.
No, you can't do that. And when the book is called Taking Back Trump's America, Why We Lost the White House and How We'll Win It Back, its author is Peter Navarro, who was there from the beginning to the end of the Trump administration. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. 22 and a half years, it'll be 23 very soon, of serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Your phone calls are welcome, and I've had quite a few naysayers today. I love getting the naysayer calls. So if you disagree with something I'm saying, we've always made it an open invitation and said you'll go right to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. This segment of the show is brought to you by Valhalla Tea Company. It's made by veterans to help veterans by donating $1 from every bag sold at ValhallaTea.com. And if you'd like to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-439-5277. Let's go to Rod, who's listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Rod, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, so I run a little horse boarding place out in Halsey, Oregon. I got five flags sitting out there along the highway that everybody comments on. And my boarders are all pretty conservative, and every now and then we run into a liberal one. And so I always have two questions for them. And to me, the answer is always the same. The first question is, eliminating personalities, name one thing that Donald Trump did wrong for the country. And the second question is, name one thing that Joe Biden has done correct for the country. To me, the answer is always the same.
I'd agree with you because, Rod, when I get those naysayers, I don't get too many these days. And it's kind of a surprise. When Hillary Clinton ran for president, there would be Hillary fans who'd call in and I'd say, okay, tell me what she accomplished. And they'd say, well, you know. And I say, no, I don't know. I know she was the first lady of Arkansas for a while, and she let her husband cheat around. And then she was the first lady of the United States for a while, and she let her husband cheat around because that was the price, I guess, she had agreed to pay in exchange for being married to somebody important. And then she got, you know, the bonus round. She got to be Secretary of State for 4 years, and she flew a lot on airplanes but didn't actually accomplish a lot. At least some of them would say, well, she's done this and done that. They couldn't really come up with much of anything. These days, the fans of Joe Biden, I guess the folks who voted for him, and supposedly 81 million of them out there, if you are to believe the 2020 election results. Yeah, supposedly. But 81 million people, and I don't get people calling me up these days saying, because I did during Obama. I got lots of people who call and say, well, Obama's done this, and he got his Obamacare. And I said, well, that's a, you know, that's a booby prize, because Obamacare has done a lot of damage both to individuals and to business and everything else. But okay, at least you think that's something cool he did. But with Joe Biden, nobody calls the show to say, unless they're being sarcastic or they're saying, I'm going to tell you all the great things, why gas prices have never been higher, you know, and oil companies have never made more money, et cetera, et cetera. But who could come up with something that Joe has done in the last 19 months that is even halfway competent, let alone being that was great for America? And yeah, I'd love to get, well, they know what's going to happen if they call up and say, well, he's been a great commander in chief. Really? Tell me about how Afghanistan went.
Yeah. No joke. I was in the service, and that just really irritated the dickens out of me, being polite. So I have 11 brothers and sisters, and at least two of them voted for Obama. The thing that I find with most of the Democrats, and I don't hear it said enough, most Democrats vote with their emotions. They don't vote on fact. Josh Hawley missed a grand opportunity when he had a professor on from Stanford when she was talking emotions and he was talking facts, and she was talking feelings and he was talking science. And so the point that I think people ought to make a lot more vociferously, as you were, vocally, is that, you know, the Democrats are speaking a different language. They're speaking psychology, and the Republicans are speaking biology.
I'd agree with you there. And, Rod, that's one of the problems. People say, what's the difference between a conservative and a liberal? I said conservatives think and liberals feel. And they say, well, that sounds like a slight, like an insult. And I said, well, take it any way you want to take it. But if somebody says, you know, if your wife came to you and said, hey, I really feel like our family would be better off in that house. And she points to something that's way outside your price range. And you go, that's great to feel that way. The problem is, how do you actually get it done? So I do know one of the biggest problems conservatives have in politics is they're not very good at marketing their positions. I mean, in a lot of ways, we've got a fat opportunity right now. You've got an economy that is just in terrible shape, and it's coming home to every single American family, and especially those who don't make as much.
Do you think that the Republicans, you know, assuming they take the Senate and the House, do you think they ought to push for Mitch McConnell to not be in charge of this thing?
Because I think Mitch McConnell should be out. I think he should be out as the leader. So, you know, yes.
Because there's also the argument that the Republicans should not go to the lowest denominator the way the Democrats do and fight, you know, as dirty as they do, because basically everything that they say is the opposite. It's pure projection. So, you know, at some point in time, where do you draw the line where the Republicans learn how to fight and take it to the House, so to speak?
I think that's one of the biggest problems is Republicans will talk a great game. And my biggest fear is we'll get the majorities in the House and the Senate, and then they'll have 50 different explanations for why they can't get it done.
Paul Ryan.
Paul Ryan was worse. He was a sellout and a traitor. But if the Republicans get back there and they say, well, Joe's going to veto this stuff, fine. Put stuff on his desk that's eminently reasonable, like control the border and like get a handle on inflation, like start drilling for oil. And when Joe vetoes it, tell the American public he is vetoing your country out from under you. You've got the Lars Larson Show.